Welcome to the Love Joy Hour, sponsored by Cook 100 degree boiling hot water straight from your kitchen tap. As you know by now, I live in the future as my cooker tap not only does 100 degree boiling hot water, it also does chilled filtered water and chilled sparkling filtered water too. I love my cooker tap. If you can afford it, I highly recommend you getting one. Absolutely great bit of kit. Thanks for all the lovely feedback I've had over the last few months. Feels like we've got quite a community of people listening to us these days. They're learning stuff whilst maybe walking the dog, doing the housework, going for a run, or at work. There seems to be a lot of people listening when they're at work. Naughty listeners. Today's hour is 15 questions to Harry Hill. I really like Harry Hill. I think he's a really good bloke. 15 questions. So I say 15 questions. I have no idea how many we'll get through. And I'll be honest with you, the collection of questions I've got now is more than 15 because I keep adding and changing and chopping. I don't know. It's just like a clumsy method for having a conversation, but one I seem to enjoy, and so do the guests. Last year, Harry had his autobiography out called Fight. I thoroughly enjoyed reading it, very honest. There was lots of autobiographies out last year written by comedians because of the pandemic. They took time out and they were all really good because they did them slightly differently because, you know, comics have that brain, the wisdom and the integrity to make it amusing and try and do it a little bit differently. But I thoroughly enjoyed Harry Hill's very honest account of show business because he talks all about his successes, and there's many, very successful man. He also talks about his failures. He also does this thing where he talks about comedy and how it works all the time. So he'll mention a comic and says, this is the style of comedy he does. This is how he does it, which I really enjoyed. I loved it. He's done so many things. Let's look through some of his CV. The Harry Hill, that was the Harry Hill show, or it was just called Harry Hill. Harry Hill's TV Burp, You've Been Framed, Stars in Their Eyes. Stars in Their Eyes, yeah, he talks about that in the book. Harry Hill's Tea Time, Harry Hill's Alien Fun. These are all the TV shows he's done. Junior Bake Off. Obviously, he's done a myriad of stand-up. He's written loads of books, and he's also done the music. He's done two musicals here, according to this. He's got Tony, a Tony Blair rock opera. I don't remember that one. And he's also got I Can't Sing, the X Factor musical, which he talks about again in his book. It didn't quite work, even though he really loved it. He went to a huge venue. And in his book, he says that the venue was just too big for such a, you know, for an early musical. I think that's what he's saying. He's also had a film out, the Harry Hill movie. Let's meet him. Let's talk to him. Let's put 15 or so questions to him, or five or six, 10, however many we get through. Here's Harry Hill. Harry, thank you for joining me today. How are you?
Sorry, I'm just fascinated by the increase in energy when you turn your microphone on, Tim, because we had a little preamble before where you were, yeah, I'm just going to take about an hour. These are the questions I've done. It's like when you phone up, if I'm doing a tour date, right, and in, you know, Stoke or something, they say, oh, you know, can you go on the Stoke breakfast show? And it's the same thing. You phone up and you say, yeah, just, yeah, hi, Harry. Yeah, thanks for coming. Oh, okay, we're just going to put you on now. Hi, everyone. It's Harry.
Harry, it always makes me laugh when people go, do you know what I like about your show, Tim, and what you do is you come across like, and you're just really very natural. I thought, no way. If you actually met me in real life, yeah, I'm monotone, I'm boring.
That's true, everyone. I remember having one of my favorite reviews of a radio show I did was it said a half an hour of forced jollity. And I thought, there's a few of those around.
Yeah, there is. All right. I love your book, by the way. I told you that when I met you. There was a good lot of biographies out. Yours was very, very honest. And that's why I liked it. You did, not only did you talk about all your successes, which are many, you also talked about your failures.
Yeah, the flops. Well, it's funny because my mum phoned me up and said, oh, you know, why just put yourself down in the book, you know, all this. And I think that, you know, your successes speak for themselves. Everyone knows about your successes. And the odd thing for me actually is, because although when you have failures, to you, they're like the most important thing in the world, and they kind of, you know, you get dragged down by them at that time. But what I found is that on the whole, people just tend to forget about the about those sort of things that haven't gone quite how you'd hoped. Weirdly, I don't know if you found that.
Yeah, what I loved about your book the most, though, is how hard you tried to do this.
It's
it's been a real. And I always say everyone who's ever made it, it's been a real slog for everyone, hasn't it? You know?
Yeah. I think I've probably had quite an easy ride compared to a lot of people. But yeah, I was very motivated. And I make this point in the book that it's not necessarily the funniest people or the most talented people that get on. It's the most pushy. And certainly when I started out, I was so pushy. You know, I was, I can remember doing a gig in, I was booked to do an open spot, so that's like 5 minutes unpaid in Birmingham in the winter, and I got the train to Birmingham, and it was thick snow, right? And I couldn't get to the bus to the gig, so I walked to the gig, which is like 5 miles or something from this, trudging through the snow. I got there, and the guy says, "Oh no, it's you know, we've had to cancel this, you know, it's because there's hardly anyone turned up." I said, "We're not canceling it. We're doing it." Oh, okay. I forced them to do it, even though, you know, I was only doing 5 minutes and wasn't being paid. I mean, I think you have to have that, really. You have to, I think showbiz is very superficially very attractive. And that's why a lot of people go into it, right? But we both know, unless you're either extraordinarily talented, so there's no one else does what you do, which only goes so far, actually. Otherwise, you just got to be really, really, you got to be prepared to knock on doors and get turned down.
Well, the
booed off, you know.
Yeah, the biggest problem with the TV industry, and you and Bob both talk about this in your books, is we've got gatekeepers, people who stop things going on TV. They're the commissioning editors, and they're the talent. But I did talk to Ben Elton this week on my show, and I said to him,
"Oh, did you? How's he?"
I love him.
He's back doing stand-up, isn't he?
He seems excited about it. But there was an amazing conversation with him and Russell Howard and stuff during the ad breaks, because Russell Howard has got Netflix specials, and, you know, he's Flavor of the Month. He's a young kid. Ben Elton, in my mind, is an absolute, I love Russell, by the way, but he's an absolute legend. Mm. And yet he's having to start all over again because, you know, Netflix don't want him for a special at the moment. But
it's interesting that. I mean, I was talking to, you know, Sean Knott was a good friend of mine, and, you know, sadly he died earlier in the year, but we were talking about this, and he was saying, he was talking about, it was a comic that was moaning that he couldn't get, you know, the work he wanted because it's all that, you know, they want young people and it's this guy and that guy. And as Sean said, if you're young, you want to see young comics.
Yeah, it's true.
And you know, if you, and the people that go out on the whole and buy tickets for stuff are younger people. You know, young kids want to see young bands and they want to see young comics. So I mean, that is just the way it goes.
Yeah,
and I think you just have to swallow that, and you just have to, you know, find your audience and try and keep them. You know, funnily enough, I do gigs now, right? And I look out at the crowd and I think, why are all these old people here?
Very valuable.
Because they're my age, you know, they're the people that, you know, watch me from the start.
And let's face it, Ben Elton's not doing badly. He's got a musical running for 20 years. It's been running, the We Will Rock You, and he's got so many books and stuff like that.
And it's terrible.
Yeah, it is. but we did
a terrible musical.
I did say to him on the show, because I started reading back about the young ones, and it's similar to Vic and Bob and your shows. As well as saying there's a lot of idiots out there who don't put stuff on TV, the people who do put stuff like you and Vic and Bob and Ben Elton's, you know, young ones and stuff on TV, they're the unsung heroes, because no one knows whether we're going to like stuff you do. We love it, but no one knows that at the time, do they? Because it's so weird.
Yeah. Well, you know, no one knows anything. But what always surprises me, Tim, is that if you're the commissioning editor and someone comes to you with the idea for the young ones or for, you know, Vic and Bob show, and you would think, well, okay, it may not be popular, but it'll be a lot of fun. to yeah. try to find out, you know, and that kind of enthusiasm just for the challenge of it is the thing that seems to have disappeared, in that everyone is just seems to be playing safe and wants to repeat a version. You know, we, you know, I have like a little production company, and Channel 4 recently did this, well, in the summer, they did this call out. They wanted a new show. They wanted a new light entertainment show, right? So they asked me to pitch some ideas, and the brief was, we want something like Taskmaster. And I thought, well, you've got Taskmaster. What do you want another one for? You know, they never, I always think you never know what you want until you're offered it.
You know? That's what Noel Gallagher said. He said, because when I worked at XFM, we did lots of research on the tracks, and it used to drive me nuts because we'd be playing the same songs over and over again because they research well.
The playlist.
Noel Gallagher said, fuck research. He goes, no one knew they wanted Jimi Hendrix until you gave them Jimi Hendrix.
Well, that's it.
And they said he would have researched terribly, and yet everyone loves Jimi Hendrix. And I agree with him, you know. That's
a funny thing in my... I think that's a funny chapter in my book when I get the job as a Capital Radio DJ.
Yeah, because you admit you were crap, but the amount of work you put into that was phenomenal, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was stupid. It was really stupid. You know, if for anyone who hasn't read the book, and there's probably a few left, is I used to write a script. I just couldn't think of anything to say on the top of my head. I mean, I think that's, you probably do need a kind of posse. That's why the posse grew up, didn't it? So you had people to bounce off. But I was just like, in that, the weird thing was, I'd go in on the Sunday, no one was in that Capital Radio building. There was like a security guard and me,
yeah,
and the technician. I always thought, well, if I was, you know, like a terrorist, I could easily just walk in, take over and broadcast my whatever it was, you know, my
propaganda
manifesto. Yeah in fact, I might do that. Might do that.
I had this conversation with Christian O'Connell on here because we were at XFM together, and I was a daytime DJ to begin with. They brought me in, and I eventually got to the stage where I couldn't even lift the fader because I had nothing to say. And I said, I used to say, this is just bollocks. And so I said to him, can I do a show like another time and get some people in? Yeah. And eventually they went, yeah, let's put a posse with you. And I had Carl Pilkington with me and Andy Ashton and people like that. As soon as I had a posse, suddenly I could do something because I was talking to someone. It was like,
yeah. But also, you know what? When I listen to the radio, I don't want to hear people talking. I just want to hear the music. You know, I don't want to hear. It's all this kind of forced thing of, phoning with your funny story, and then never, you know, as people sort of desperately forcing their funny stories on you. And, you know, it's just that turnover, isn't it? If you are doing a daily show, it's just turnover, which is just, you know, they ought to just admit it. Look, today we haven't got anything for you. We're just going to play records back
today. I can't lift the fader. I'm so sorry. Right, let me ask you some questions. We'll start and see how we get on. We'll never get through any of these, but I'll start at the beginning. What's one piece of advice you'd like to give our listeners that has been invaluable to your life?
Well, it's as a comic, the best advice I got was, if it's going badly, get off, and if it's going well, get off. You know, that was the best advice I got, because there's a temptation when it's going well to just milk it and milk it and milk it, you know. And I mean, obviously, if when you're on stage, but also if you've got a series that's going, it's really popular, and you know, well, my fear with particularly with TV Burt was always, which obviously was my big success, was that you know, we'd hit a bad patch, and you know, people really hate you if they've got a show you've got a show that they love, and then you start to sort of churning out and it's a bit ropey. Then they really, really turn on you then. Do you know what I mean? It's almost worse than having a flop that they ignored all the way through.
What I loved about your book is, I said in my intro actually to the listeners here, the analysis of comedy. You keep giving us snippets of how comedy works, and when you talk about some of your peer group and stuff, and you say, say for instance, Stuart Lee, he likes to do the repeating the sentence thing, and then and, you know, we're all aware of that, but you're analysing the comics for us, and I really enjoy that. Are you very analytical with comedy?
Well, I think, you know, it's kind of a love letter to stand up and to comedy, that book, in some ways, in that, you know, I do have this absolute love for it, and I'm endlessly interested in why things work and other things don't work. I've got this routine at the moment, right, because I'm working up for a tour, which is, I say, I've got something in my shoe, right? I say, oh dear, I've got a bit of grit in my shoe, and so I have to take the shoe off. So I take the shoe off, and so I've got a bit of, oh no, it's actually inside the sock, right? So then I say, I've got to take my sock off, right? And then I've got this, basically, I've got a 20-foot sock, which I have to put on before I go on, right? It goes all the way up to my thigh. And so, and that's very funny that I take this thing off and it gets longer and longer. And it is a real nice bit. And then I say, and after that, I say, oh no, I've got one in the other shoe, right? and then I put my foot out and I get someone to pull it and it just comes off. It's a very short sock, a tiny sock, right? And my daughter came along. She said, oh, I wanted the second sock to be long as well, right? And I thought, well, that's not a punchline, but I thought, well, maybe I'll try it. So I get another sock, which is even longer than the 20-foot sock. You know, it's 25 feet. So I've got these two socks. I take the first one off, and I do the second one. And the process of taking the second one off is really funny, but inevitably it comes off and there's no punchline and it's slightly a damp squib. Now, the only way I could find that out was to try it. And, you know, this is my point about, you know, no one knows. You know, that it might have been even funnier to have a longer second sock on, but you know, you just don't know till you try it.
You know what? I interviewed Jimmy Carr on this podcast, and I talked to him about his I talked to him about Mickey Flanagan actually, and his out routine. I said that, you know, that kind of like catapulted him into just this huge. Yeah, you know, and I talked about a viral joke, and he went, I realized that my jokes are not long enough to be viral. This is what he said. He said, so I sat down, I've timed all the really big viral jokes. So he goes, I'm trying to make all my jokes longer so they can become viral because I don't have one. They're too quick. They're too shotgun. I thought, that's amazing that you lot are sitting around doing that, how that works.
Well, he's slightly different he's kind of, very analytical in that sense, you know, and that's also about success and his interest in what makes people popular, actually. That's right. I think that he has another interest in that, because he doesn't have any, he's not warm. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, he talks about that in his book. Yeah,
he
says that's his act. He's not warm. Yeah,
So that sometimes can be a struggle for comics. I mean, in I like that. I like those comics, you know, as I say in the book, the sort of deadpan comics who just sort of live or die on their material. Yeah. So it's just about the gag. But, and that's how I started out. But the difficulty with that is that, you know, your next gag has to be funnier than your last one. And if you're doing an hour or however long Jimmy does these days, it's a really, really tough call to get that that number of jokes.
Yeah, they machine gun them, don't they? Right, next question. What's the best moment of your career so far?
Well, I'm going to say flanning Piers Morgan.
Where?
I did Good Morning Britain, and I was doing this kids tour, which involved, and we hadn't sold that many tickets, really. I had to, and in the show, I did this thing where I showed kids how to make a custard pie, and then I got them up and I got them to throw a custard pie into their dad's face, basically. And so I went on Good Morning Britain and did it to Piers, and it was a really, that went viral, actually. I think it's the only time I've ever been viral, but that was a big moment. I got texts from all over the place.
How did he react? Did he enjoy it?
Well, he was in on it, you know, and actually, you know what he's like? He's so, it's very interesting to me. He's so kind of, he's so clear about what makes things popular. And, you know, he's a bit like Jimmy in that sense. Then he's not just doing it for the fun. He's seeing what will come out of it. Do you know what I mean? So he actually whispered to me. He knew I was going to, because they had to get his permission. And he said to me in the ad break, just before I was going to do it, he said to me, because they had an item about papooses. I don't know if you remember it. He was sort
yeah.
of, that it was sort of weak of people for blokes to have papooses. So I was just going to flan him. But he came over to me in the ad break and said, make it about the pupuses.
Right? Did you?
So I said, and this is for all the blokes that carry. I just did what I was told, basically, you know, like I was a freedom fighter.
It's
an interesting way. I mean, the way he operates is nothing is left a chance with that guy.
He doesn't walk away from it, does he? Like, you know,
no.
So something will happen, whatever it is, you know, and everybody else in the industry goes, well, I'm going to avoid that because, you know, he goes, well, I'm going steaming right in there because that's what everyone's talking about. And he just doesn't care. Yeah. Very thick skin. Mm. And gets on with it. All right. What's the worst moment in your career?
Like the first time I went down really badly, probably. You know, when I gave up my, actually, no, I'm going to say I gave up my job as a doctor and I wrote this comedy play about being a doctor. I took it to the Edinburgh Festival. So this is in the summer of 1990. And I had such high hopes. And it just got destroyed. No one came. You know, there were three of us in the show. And one night there were two people in the audience. There were more people on stage than off. And we got this terrible review from this guy, which is what I opened the book with. And the review was, this show is a dud and deserves only box office failure, which, you know, for basically, I mean, it wasn't like I was a big production. I just financed it myself. It was a pretty, pretty cold of that reviewer to say that. You know, I don't know what he was trying to prove.
Yeah, horrific being a critical reviewer, though. I mean, what a horrible job.
Yeah, what a horrible job.
Because for a little while, I did film review, Harry, and it was for a short period of time. And I started every film review with, look, please remember, I've never written or made a film, right? I've never produced one, and yet I'm going to comment on this work. And it's like, and I just always thought, this is shit. How can I be telling someone their film's crap and I've never been anywhere close to making a film, you know?
Yeah. Well, I think that, I don't know about, I think you probably can decide, but I think the problem with anyone who reviews stuff for a long time is that they've forgotten what it's like just to go to the cinema and buy a ticket and be sort of wide-eyed about it. They come in with an attitude and they have to basically come down on one side or the other, don't they? Most of the time they can't.
Yeah.
It was okay. You might like it, which is probably what 90% of films is. It's true of probably 90% of films.
Talking about the worst bits of your career, a couple of things. What first thing you in your book, I love it when you talk about doing an audience with. Because I went on straight onto YouTube to watch
you watched it.
Do you know what? It's brilliant. It's so
I haven't watched it since. I couldn't watch it.
Honestly, it is so funny. And do you know this? Because I watched it and then about two or three days later, Danny Baker tweeted, I'm just reading Harry Hill's book and he moans about an audience with, and he puts the link up to YouTube. And so people are, and they're talking about how good it is. I mean,
how funny.
This is a really amazing bit of TV, but the celebrity audience didn't like it when you were there or something, didn't they?
Well, I can't. I mean, most of the people in the audience are not celebrities, is the truth. Right. So there's maybe 20 that you'd recognize and maybe 10 that you wouldn't have no idea. I didn't put it in the book, but the best thing to come out of that was that Lorna Luft, who is Judy Garland's sister, right?
Right.
Half sister, maybe sister. She was in the audience. I mean, you wouldn't recognize her at all. You'd recognize. She's Judy Garland's daughter. So she's Liza Minnelli's half sister. And my wife's friend, Hannah, was a massive Judy Garland fan. She found herself sitting next to and chatting to Lorna Luft. And that is the best thing to come out of that show, as far as I was concerned. They didn't. I mean, you know, the biggest bugbear for me was Chris Tarrant. He was the big star that that came along. You know, it was a very odd audience. You know, like I say in the book, the kind of days of the glory days of A-listers, you know, when an audience would started out, there would be like Michael Caine would go along, there'd be Michael Parkinson, and they'd all be laughing. And it's the first time we'd ever seen those people kind of just relaxed and enjoying, you know, it was like a big club, wasn't it?
Yeah.
You know, and it was very thrilling. But by the time I get to do it, you know, like I say, I've got Richard Stilgoe and Hank Marvin in the audience. You know, I mean, nice people, but you know, no one's tuning in to see them. And afterwards, Hank Marvin comes up to me, goes, "Yeah, it was great." He goes, "Yeah, I'd never heard of you before." Actually, I went to the Adele one. You know, I was invited to the Adele audience. Did you see that the other night?
I didn't watch it, no, but yeah.
Well, that felt like it was the old days of an audience with him. They were kind of, you turn the corner and there's, you know, what's this, Bryan Cranston from Breaking Bad, and there's Stormzy and there's Dua Lipa, and, you know, it's like, oh, yeah, this is what it could be.
What I love about that one, the Adele one, is Alan Carr, when she calls Carr into stage, because I thought the pressure, Alan Carr's not been around for a little while since the pandemic. He hasn't got a show on at the moment or anything. And I thought the pressure to go up there and perform, and I thought he delivered. I really did.
Well, what they didn't show you was that he introduced her, right? So on the night, it was at the Palladium. It's so exciting, right? Because the audience, as the celebrities were arriving, we were all in the stalls. All the people in the dress circle and above were members of the public. I think a lot of them were NHS workers. And as people arrived, like Stormzy arrived, they'd all be cheering, and Stormzy would be turning around waving. And Alan Carr gets up and introduces her and was really, really funny. He was really funny before that. So I think, you know, by the time he came on, and obviously they're very good friends, I mean, she's almost like a female version of Alan Carr, the way she, you know, her kind of sense of humor. So by the time she got him up, he knew everyone was on his side, I think.
Right. Okay. Well, because he did deliver. And I thought, you know what it's like being called up on somewhere. It's happened to me a few times.
I was nervous because they said there was this whole thing about asking questions. And I thought, oh, God, I don't want to ask a question. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. By the way, if you haven't watched it, watch Harry's audience with it. The whole routine about, are you a cat person or a snake person? It's just brilliant. There's no one else who does that. Well, no one else who does that, who just keeps coming back to the same shit gag. And it's brilliant, but it's a great gag because it's so funny. I love it.
Yeah, that cat routine. Yeah, it was.
I just thought the whole thing was hysterical.
Oh,
and talking about worst moments you could. The only bit in the book that you genuinely seemed upset about was when your musical didn't work
that was awful. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You loved it, but it was just the wrong venue. Is that right? Is that the conclusion?
Well, we don't know. We don't know what quite why it didn't work. But I mean, the fact is, no one ever opened a show at the Palladium. No one ever opened a musical, an original musical at the Palladium. And we certainly shouldn't have done that. I mean, what everyone does actually is... they open it in Manchester and they get it in shape, you know, going around the country, getting it in shape. And then they open in, you know, we were probably selling as many tickets as the Book of Mormon, but the Book of Mormon was a big success because it was full. They sold 900 seats, but ours was like a third empty. So it was, I mean, I felt particularly bad for the, you know, the crew. I mean, there were hundreds of people backstage, and you know, the cast, and they'd all, you know, what people don't know is that you know, when you do previews, the cast are on a very low wage, right? And the promise is, so you do perhaps a month, we did 6 weeks I think of previews, and they're on, I don't know, 100 quid a night or something, and with the promise that when it opens, obviously, then they start getting their, you know, still not very well paid, or unless you're a big name. And that didn't happen. You know, basically the thing ran for 6 weeks, where we'd taken the Palladium had been booked for a year. You know, they were hoping it would run for a year. But yeah, I knew it was a bad idea. We all got swept up in the kind of machismo of it. You know, that whole Simon Cowell circus.
Yeah, well, for anyone who doesn't know, I did in the thing in the intro. It's called "I Can't Sing the X Factor Musical," but it worked though, didn't it?
It was good. It was good. I was very happy with it, and actually, it got good reviews. Bearing in mind that everyone was sort of out to get it. I mean, it was interesting from my point of view is that suddenly I was aware of kind of Simon Cowell's how everyone was sort of out to get Simon Cowell. Obviously, he sort of courts that to a certain extent. But obviously I was slightly caught in the crossfire in that, you know, that old line about when you sup with the devil, use a long spoon.
with something like that, is there not a way that that can be revived, or are you just not interested in doing
it? No, I tried for a long time to get it revived, and we nearly had it off the ground. Then the COVID thing killed it off. But my outlook now is it's better to do something new. So we have got this new musical, which is me and Steve Brown, who wrote the songs and the music.
Yeah.
And the lyrics, frankly. It's about Tony Blair, and that, you know, all being well, we're hoping that will open up in the in May.
Yeah, June. I just said in the intro, a Tony Blair rock opera. I didn't know anything about that. So that's brand new, is it? And just didn't happen because of the pandemic.
The Tony Blair thing, no, that is happening. I mean, it's been slowed down at everything, but it is happening in the spring.
Right, okay. And where's
the
that?
The X-Factor thing, I think, is just dead. You know, it's just dead in the water. There's so many people to wrangle with that. You know, I mean, Simon's got a very different outlook about his profile now as well. You know, we had a lot of stuff in about him being a bit of a philanderer and all that. And obviously he's now a family man. And so I think it would just be I don't think it's not worth going back on. It's probably not worth going back on. Unless you've run out of ideas, which I don't feel I have, it's probably best not to just, you know, resurrect stuff.
All right, next question. What does success mean to you?
I think success means probably the opportunity to do other things, you know?
I think it means
that's what flops don't get. What you don't get with a flop is people falling. I mean, that's why we've struggled to get another musical off the ground.
Right.
And success is not about reviews and about awards, is the other thing that is a hard lesson. It's about money. So it's only really when you start making money for someone that you're seen as successful. So there's a lot of programs on TV which I don't think are very good, perhaps. Or films or whatever in this stuff. But if they're popular and they make money for people, then they want to make more of them.
Yeah. I think success for you is got to be TV Burt, because
if you want a name of something, yeah, sure.
Well, no, I didn't, but I just TV Burt is a vehicle that appeal to so many different sets of people. It was me watching it every week, and I don't really watch Saturday night TV particularly, or early Saturday night TV. And then you had family sitting down for it, and everyone found it just so bloody amusing. I mean, I still, every time I was tweeting about you coming on Sunday brunch, I put that Riverside song on, because it just because you danced around with the Queen Vic head to the Riverside. It's just funny. It really is funny.
Yeah. I mean, it was kind of the perfect format for me, but in that, I mean, what I used to get quite a lot of prior to that was, oh, he's kind of a cult comic. You know, he's not mainstream enough. And so I think, you know, I make this point in the book that as a comic, you can't really make a TV career out of doing your material.
Yeah.
Because you just use it up. And even Jimmy Carr can't turn over that amount of stuff. So you have to find a way of being funny that doesn't use your material up. And TV Burt worked really well for me because it was TV that everyone was very accessible. So everyone was watching it, and everyone was watching the same stuff back then. You know, this is 10 years ago and it's changed a lot, but there's a few shows that everyone watches, but not many. And it was a weekly thing. So you felt like you had to watch it, you know, and people weren't doing catch up and stuff. And I could sort of impose my kind of slightly perhaps left field sense of humor on it. And it allowed people in that kind of silliness. It didn't sort of alienate people. So it wasn't, I don't know, where some people might have thought, oh, you know, badgers or it's a bit weird. They were quite happy to have me chased around a desk by the Queen Vic. Riverside, let's go, you know. So yeah, it was, and you know, and I made this kind of pact. Me and the writers made this pact that we would make it, as you know, laugh out loud, funny all the time, which was a really tough, you know, was quite, you know, if we'd start, you know, if you look at Gogglebox, which I really like actually, Gogglebox, which is sort of the heir of TV Burp in many ways, in that it's about, you know, it's about the week's TV. it's a very soft laugh on that. So it's, you can really laugh at it, but you're not laughing every 10 seconds. You know, it's a, it's quite a relaxed laugh. You know, I'm not saying the laughs aren't as good, but it's how you start. So if you start bang, 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 you sort of have to keep going. You can't then have a big lull. So we made a sight rod for our backs for that. But I mean, I'm very proud of it for that, you know, I don't think, honestly, I don't think there's ever been laugh for laugh. I don't think there's ever been a show as funny as that, really. Certainly not one that I've been involved
in. It was brilliant, absolutely.
And I'm not saying that's about me, because, you know, there were five of us involved in putting it together. So
yeah. I think what you tapped into was what the general public are doing when they're watching TV as well. Because we're all sitting there going, what is that? And that's what Gogglebox, as you say. There's a brilliant moment on Gogglebox the other week where Dermot O'Leary and... I can't remember the name of the woman who Gavin and Stacey woman. Joanna
Scanlon.
Let's call her that. Paige. That's it, Joe Paige. And they're presenting this show called The Pet Show. Yeah. You would have loved it, because what they did is they bought the woman comes in with a little dog and says, "I'm having Fluffy mounted by a taxidermist," right?
Oh, yeah, my daughter told me about this.
Oh, yeah. She goes, "I want him to meet the dog because I want him to do the dog when he's dead." But they keep cutting back to the people sitting on their sofas who were just taking the mic, laughing. Then they get this brilliant scene where they do this reveal of this cat, and it's like one of your stuffed animals on TV, but it literally could be one of your sketches. And everyone's laughing, and Derma and Joanna having to keep a straight face. It's just the most beautiful piece of TV. Well cut around. So yeah, no, I love all that. But the amount of work you put into TV Burp, it's really funny, because when I did Soccer AM, you end up watching football because you're looking for clips for the show. And so I really understood it when you said you end up just watching hours and hours of TV, and obviously you were sent tapes, but everything you're watching, you're thinking, where's the funny bit? Well, what can I dissect here? I was looking for third eyes and strange things happening and stuff like that. And you end up never watching the ball. You're watching for what everyone else isn't watching. And I assume that's what you ended up doing.
Yeah, that's true. You know, you get you develop a skill and, you know, we got very good at it, but you know, I mean, that's partly why we had to stop it, was that the sets, EastEnders, the sets were, never changed, so we knew we'd spotted everything in the Queen Vic. Looked vaguely like a face, or, you know, it was like it was kind of diminishing returns in some ways. And I think shows started becoming kind of more knowing. They were almost sort of adding their own TV Burp voiceover.
Harry, I've moved this next question up the running order because I want to discuss it. And then I've added a question. The first question is, have you ever seen a ghost or a UFO?
Well, I hesitate to say a ghost, but I did see something. We were living in Clapham in this old, well, every house in Clapham, I guess, is an old house. And I remember seeing there's something out the corner of my eye, like a white sort of thing going down into the basement. And that, I'm not saying it was a, I thought, oh, that's a ghost. I don't believe in ghosts. And it's, the idea is ridiculous to me, but I thought at the time, oh yeah, it's a ghost. I did think that's a ghost. And I think I can't necessarily explain what it was.
So what way have you had any, do you think it's a hallucination, or do you think it was, what do you think?
I don't know what it was. That's why I'm saying it's a ghost.
Right. Next question then. If we were to find out one of them was real, would you rather it be ghosts or aliens?
Why are you interested in this?
Because I've become obsessed with it. I go online all the time. See, what I go online all the time. In? I'd really like there to be... Look,
everyone
be,
would like there to be ghosts, sure, yeah.
No, it's not the ghosts. Oh. I'm more of an alien man myself because I haven't really done much preparation for retirement. So... I'm hoping aliens land to give me a bit of an out clause, so I don't have to worry about how I'm going to pay for everything when I'm older, you know. And maybe I could end up just, I don't know, taking on the aliens, maybe
as a plan for your retirement. Let me tell you, it's not the best one I've heard.
Well, I don't have a plan B. So, I've just become obsessed with them because I end up reading a lot of stuff online, you know. And I just kind of like the idea that this is happening. And Barack Obama, 8 months ago, said, well, we definitely know there's UFOs. We just don't know what they are. And so he said, there are unidentified flying objects. We just don't know what they are. And I'm like, why is this not front page news of every single... People just don't care.
What he's saying is that we just don't know what they are. He's not saying they are... You know, UFO, you're thinking aliens and, spaceships. But all he's saying is, anything, if you throw it up in the air, is an unidentified flying object to someone if they're far enough away.
Yeah, but if they're not aliens, Harry, they could be. I can't believe I'm having this conversation with you again about it. But if they're not aliens, then they could be Russians or Chinese, which could be even worse if they don't know what they are and they're flying around.
Sure. Well, that's probably more likely, isn't it? We don't know, but I think if they're aliens, it's very odd behavior, and to come all that way and just sort of, fly past and only one person's, it's just
all right.
It's a bit silly, isn't it?
Yeah,
to me it seems a bit silly. It's if you're looking for them, you'll find them. It's like all these conspiracy things. If you're looking for a there's always a complicated answer to it, and that is quite a far-fetched one. If you see something in the distance and you're not sure what it is, you think, "Oh, I wonder what that is."
Yeah.
What you're saying is,
God,
it's aliens.
Well, I'm not actually, because I have to check myself when I've been in reading about it all, and I do go into it. There's a great guy called Graham Hancock I talk about on this. I've tried to get him on the podcast, but he won't respond to me. And he talks about there's being a civilization, an advanced civilization tens of thousands of years ago, who built the pyramids and all that. And it wasn't the Egyptians.
Well, that's been well written. I mean, when I was a kid in the 70s, the big guy was Eric von Daniken. Do you remember him? Chariots of the Gods.
I don't know him. I'm going to look him up straight after.
Eric von Daniken, his name was. And he had these books, Chariots of the Gods. And it was all about how the Mayan civilizations and the pyramids were built by aliens. And those Aztec kind of things were all like runways, or built as runways to land their craft on, right? And I, we all believed it, and it's all very, very persuasive. And then he was completely exposed as a complete fraud, maybe 10 years ago or something. Yeah. And, some of the diagrams that he'd, the things that he'd said were runways were like the size of a 2 foot by 2 foot, but in his picture, it looked like it was 2 miles, it's all just everything bent to fulfill his theory.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Graham, I want to move on, but Graham Hancock says it's not aliens. There was a civilization, and I'm talking on behalf of him here, but an intelligent civilization who were wiped out like the dinosaurs, and we've forgotten it all, and then we came, this generation came. And I love reading it. And then I have to check, I've got a couple of mates who are conspiracy theorists with the vaccination stuff. They've really got heavily into it, and I have to keep checking myself to make sure I'm not becoming one of those people who just believes everyone's an alien and stuff. Next question. What other jobs did you do apart from entertainment? We know that you're a doctor, but again, sorry to keep going on about your book. It's probably good because you'll sell some more. But I thought it was fascinating reading about how you perceived your job as a doctor, and also the bit where you had to tell someone that you never think about this, but you had to tell someone that was it their wife had died or husband? I can't remember.
There were a lot of those cases. That's just one of them. I was 23, and it's funny because I've got a daughter who's 23, and I look at her and I'm thinking, I wouldn't want her breaking that news to me. Nothing about her. It's just, I wasn't equipped, and I should never have been in that situation. I think it's perhaps changed a lot. We got very little instruction on how to break bad news, about sort of bereavement counselling, all that kind of stuff. And frankly, it was just very, very upsetting for me as well as for the bloke I had to tell, you know. But back then, the whole attitude was from the kind of people that you work with, you know, the senior doctors, was we had to do it and you've got to do it. Get on with it. It was the thing. You know, it's the same with the hours. You know, we did 100 hours, you've got to do it. You know, there was no kind of, it was very much divide and rule.
Right.
No kind of, everyone was out for their own little career, I think.
Did you always know you were
good
funny?
Training for a showbiz.
Exactly, yeah.
I always thought I was. Well, I don't know, it's always, but I mean, yeah, I think, well, I always saw the value of jokes. I could see how people liked it when you were funny, and if you had a good joke, it was like good currency in the playground. And I think I had a sort of instinctive, other people might argue that I don't, but I have an instinctive understanding of how a joke works, you know. And I think that's just something you have probably, and you perhaps can't you don't necessarily, well, I don't know if you can learn it really. Yeah, it's a bit like playing a musical instrument, I think.
What's the that's really funny when you do that nose flute. I don't know why that's so funny, but when you're on Sunday brunch, you started playing the nose flute. You had a ukulele and a nose flute, and just that thing happening, just I couldn't stop laughing at it. It was why is that funny though? I don't know. It's just, it really is very funny.
Yeah, well, I think I think in that situation, what is funny is that it's so absurd. And I think it's partly being my age. It's partly me doing it seriously. I think if I was like laughing as well, it might not be as, I don't know. I think it's someone being kind of childlike in a grown-up world, perhaps, is part of it. I mean, you know, it's very difficult to analyze why things are funny, and often you just have to take it on face value.
What's the comedy circuit like? Are you all your generation who came up through the Edinburgh and everything? Are you all very close? Is it a nice atmosphere between
you? I think it's a nice atmosphere. I think we're you know, instinctively comedians are loners in some ways. We're not big team players, I think. You know, we are perhaps a little bit self-obsessed, but unlike actors, if you get a lot of actors together, they sort of bitch about other actors, but I don't find that with comics. And if we ever saw anyone that was really funny, we would tell them. I would always, you know, and this is not just me, I would say, you know, I would phone up Sean or whatever and say, oh, this guy's really funny, you should see him. And often if you know, like I would do a gag and someone would say to me, oh yeah, you could maybe add this to it, you know. It was always very supportive. I mean, if we felt that anyone was sort of ripping another comedian off, or you know, not necessarily just being a bit, you know, of a hack comic, then, you know, we wouldn't go and tell them, but we would just dismiss them. Perhaps we would bitch about them, but no, broadly I'd say, and bearing in mind what a competitive field it is, that might, you know, you might find that surprising. You know, I think we all, because we have, I think probably to be a comic, you do have to have a love of comedy. And I think you never lose that excitement and fun of seeing someone surprise you.
Mm.
Yeah,
I always think it's weird that there's a prize at Edinburgh, because, you know, I always feel it's weird with music when people start. It's so subjective, isn't it? And surely the prize should go to the person who sold the most records, if it's or most seats to a thing, because they're the one who won. But with the up in Edinburgh, you know, the acts are so vastly different, aren't they? And yet someone hands one an award, but it becomes quite important, doesn't it?
Well, I don't know what it's like now, but yeah, when I was around, when I was starting out, it was you know, it could really change things for you. And it did for me in many ways, largely because it would tell the TV people who to like for the next year, you know, because they don't, on the whole, go and see much comedy. I mean, the irony of the Edinburgh Festival is it's a lot of comics from London. This is the comedy festival going up to Edinburgh to be seen by a load of producers from London. It's the truth. I mean, it just is the truth. You know, it's like the Works outing. But yeah, I mean, you could say that about any awards. I think you have to treat awards as a bit of a game, really. Otherwise, you just get a bit mad.
Were you there? How was Edinburgh when you first started? Because it's apparently changed a lot over the last 20 odd years.
Well, it's got ramped up and ramped up. I mean, when I was doing it, people were complaining. You know, older comics are complaining how commercial it had become. But you know, compared to now, it's. I mean, when I went up, a few years ago. Last time I toured, I think I went up and I did sort of some warm up gigs, and I was just really amazed that there were like they've got like metal containers. You know, there's like metal containers you get. You see being unloaded from ships, they were being turned into venues. So there were like there'd be like a car park with like four of these containers in that people were doing shows in. It's just like this has gone a bit mad. But yeah, the great thing about the Edinburgh Festival is you don't have to jump over any hurdle to get in. The only thing that stops you from getting in is if you can't afford to do it. You know, no one says right what you're going to do. You don't have to be, most festivals, you have to sort of pass some kind of artistic, assessment. But anyone, if you've got the money, and that's when I first started, when I was in medical school, we took a kind of show up there. I'd never even been to the Edinburgh Festival. I just found out about it and booked a room and, you know, promoted the thing myself. You know, got the posters made and stuck them up, spent all day sticking these posters up and, I don't know if that's still the way. I don't think it's the way people do it anymore.
All right, next question. What's your relationship like with social media?
Well, the only one I do is Instagram. Talking about Sean again, it was that he said to me, I don't do any of that social media. And I said, well, I do. The only one I do is Instagram. And he said, that's like an alcoholic saying, I only drink vodka. You know, so that I do that because it seems benign, fairly benign, because it's a visual thing. It's easier to do. It's less attitude involved. And I don't read any of them. I don't read them, you know, comments on the whole.
Yeah. I wonder if comics need social media because you've got your audience, haven't you? You've got your crowd. But I suppose it's a good way of getting.
Well, no, I think you do now. And I think if I was starting off now, you'd absolutely have to. I mean, I always hoped that I was old enough not to have to bother in that my crowd, they're not the types to do it. But I think, yeah, no, I don't know. You know, it seems to me you can spend a lot of time on it with very little results. You know, I don't know if anyone's ever actually tried to make the connection between, how much you get paid out of it, you know, in real terms. I mean, some people spend all day on it, don't they? I don't know.
Yeah, I've done that many a time. My addiction to it is horrific sometimes. So
I prefer, I prefer, I mean, it's another thing in the book is that in the 70s, no one knew any celebrities. No one knew what really anything about them much. You know, you'd see them on Parkinson or you'd see them interviewed in the press or whatever, and normally it was if they just left their wife or they'd had an affair or something, but you didn't know their kind of what they have for lunch or and there was a certain mystery about celebrities, and I prefer my celebrities to be a bit more of an enigma.
Do you know what? I've been having this conversation with some PR people recently. I said, and they were brilliantly, I said to them, do you not think proper celebrities, right, proper stars, you don't know what they're having for breakfast and stuff. They're just like living their lives, you know, like that. And she went, Timber, you're not a proper star. And I went, yeah, all right. Apart from the fact that I'm not a big star, but should I, you know, really, should I be doing all this?
Get scared into doing it because we feel like if we don't do it in some ways, we're going to miss out. You know, people, this is the pressure. The pressure is, you know, from, well, it's the pressure from, you know, people who are doing it, I suppose. They sort of, you feel like, oh, well, I could be, you know, this might make the difference between this or that, or, you know, I mean, God knows.
Well, and what happens, I think the problem for comics is your tweets or your posts, your whatever you call them on Instagram, and they kind of have to be funny, don't they? Because that's your career, which means you're writing material for free. You're giving away even more material. And if you're not funny, then people start going, and I'm sure every time you tweet, someone will go, I thought you were supposed to be funny, because that's what people say to everyone. Yeah. I think it's a tough ask for comics to use social media.
Well, I think you can do that, but it's like, I think then it would be like a full-time job, wouldn't it? You'd have to spend a couple of hours every day doing it properly. And every now and then I think, oh, well, maybe I should properly do this and, you know, see if it makes... You know, if I could build up some massive following and get some kind of, you know, because that part of it is attractive to me, in the sense that you don't have to go through the commissioner, or, you know, you have got that complete control.
Mm.
But at the same time, I don't think people should work for nothing.
You talk about your writing process in the book. It's quiet. It's you know, it's full time, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I haven't done that for a while. That thing that I outline in that is like
the thing that you do for a living.
I haven't really sat down and done that thing. In fact, I'll sit down in the new year and do it properly, because I've got a tour coming up. But I think, you know, to come up with stand-up material, I do go into it in some detail. I mean, I think that's just me. A lot of people just wander around the park and come up with ideas. You know, I mean, everyone has their own way of working and also, I suppose part of it is me thinking that I'm doing something, because as I say in the book, for every 100 ideas I write, it's, you know, 2 will be good. 2 will make it into the final thing.
Yeah, it's weird actually, because I'm not sure many people know that you guys all book your shows. So you go, oh, I'm going to go on tour in autumn 2022. And that's before you've even bothered thinking of anything. And then every now and then a comic will write a title for it, like bicycle stories or something, and then have to write a story around bikes or something. But you look, I haven't even bothered writing. Is there any fear that the material is not going to come?
Yeah, I mean, there's always that sort of occasional anxiety, but I think you just have to sort of, I kind of think, well, I've always managed it in the past, and if anything, I'm, you know, I've had a lot of experience, and I should be better at it, shouldn't I? I don't know. Mm. Most people, you know, you get better at things, don't you?
So what's next for you then? I don't know, because you do, but then you get older as well, the energy levels go down.
Well, there's certainly that, but I think you have to try and see things as, you have to remember the fun of it and why you got into it in the first place, honestly. And so when I'm rolling around the floor trying to take a 20-foot sock off, you know, you have to, otherwise it would just be tragic.
I'm always really jealous of proper, you know, artists like yourself or musicians or whatever, because what, you know, if the TV all just dries up eventually and no one gives you another TV gig, you can still just go out touring constantly, can't you? And people will still find you funny. You know, it's like,
well, no one knows, you know, no one knows where any of this will end. And, you know, I mean, actually with the COVID thing, we haven't been able to do that for a lot of the year, but, there's no, you know, you can get hung up on the future, but really what you have to try and do is, you know, worry about the immediate future and not, you know, get hung up about, oh, you know, what happens if it, or what happens if this, you know, I mean, the only important thing, and this is another thing I say in the book, is your health, really. You know, as soon as you get ill, we all know people that have made big plans, and, as soon as you get ill, the game's up. Do you know what I mean? That's, you can't do anything. So you really have to make the most of your, and I'm not saying that's work, you know, you need to get the work balance right. But, and I haven't done that in the past, you know, I have just been too head down.
Yeah. coming to the end of the hour, just a couple more questions. First one, so what do you see yourself as in the future? You like Ken Dodd, 3 hours on stage, just like with a feather duster and some badges.
I don't know why he did that.
Badges, 3 hours.
I don't know why he did that. You know, and actually 3 hours was a short one. You know, I did.
I think he did it because of what you said. He remembered why he enjoyed it, and he thought, "I want to spend hours just on stage making people laugh."
Sure, yeah, yeah. I mean, I have noticed recently that I have been doing longer. I mean, I was always the guy just to get on and get off. I remember Ronnie Corbett saying the same thing. I had that sort of in common with Ronnie Corbett. It was you just want to get on, kind of prove yourself, you know, win them over, and get off.
Right.
But some people like to just, you know, hang around. What was the question?
What's the future? Like more TV, more theatre, more stand-up. But
things that interest me, really. I've got to the stage now where I can't really be bothered to. I realised the other day I don't really like working for other people. You know what I mean? So the aim would be to just sort of do what you want, wouldn't it? So this Tony Blair musical would be great if that comes off. And then, you know, and I've got this little film project up my sleeve. TV, I'm doing Junior Bake Off, and that comes back in the spring, which is a great job for me, actually. It was an unusual one in that previously everything I've done has been heavily scripted, you know, but even that radio show. And so I had to kind of take a slight leap of faith with that, in that I don't, you know, I turn up and it's a tent full of kids and I just have to make up stuff and go around and try and make them laugh. Yeah. And actually it's been an interesting challenge for me. And I've really, really enjoyed it a lot of the time because of the kids, because they're just so surprising. So, but I don't have I don't have any plans to do like a big Saturday night type thing. To me, that just, I kind of start to get anxious a bit about that, the kind of stress of that and the, you know, how you're kind of so exposed and, you know, because I did it for so long, you know.
Mm. Final question, Harry. I've thoroughly enjoyed
it. It may change.
Final question I ask all my guests is, what's the meaning of life?
Not dying. Probably. Trying to enjoy it. Trying to keep it in perspective and enjoy it, yeah.
Thanks, mate. Top man. Thanks for doing that podcast for us. I thoroughly enjoyed it. Your book, Fight, is out now. When's your tour start then? When are you going to do that?
That is October the 5th. I think there's I think it's called harryhilltour.com. You can get the dates. But yeah, you can follow me on Instagram you know, it's sort of about 40 dates around the country. I'm really looking forward to it, actually, because I haven't done it for so long.
Perfect. Cheers, mate. Thank you, Harry.
Cheers, Tim.